Oh, thank you. And thank you very much for those warm words of welcome and introduction. And good evening to everybody. Thank you to Paul for the invitation to spend some time with you over these next few months addressing the question, why business matters to God. And what I really hope to show you is that business certainly does matter to God. Indeed, business matters to every single one of us, essentially because God has called business into being and God has called people into business. Indeed, the very fact that he has done that is the beginning of any authentically Christian approach to ethics in business. But more of that as we go. Let me just give you a few words. I don't need to repeat the words of introduction that Paul said about me. It's always slightly worrying when people introduce you and you hear things about you, about yourself, that you think can't possibly be true and are far too generous. It was the point when Paul said I'd spent 10 years as a minister of the Church of England, which is true. And I thought, quite long enough. But there we are. What I thought I would do is just give a few words of introduction about the organization I run. So it's called the Center for Enterprise Markets and Ethics. The website is www.thecemeoneword.org. So do have a look. And in essence, we're a body that seeks to advocate for the market economy, but built on sound ethical and biblical principles. So we do a lot of things exploring the relationship between theology and business, economics and business, economics and theology, and so on and so forth. Everything we do is rooted in that way. And I suppose I've been equipped to be able to do this because of the background that Paul described. It is interesting, isn't it, that sometimes you look back at the things that have happened to you in your Christian life journey, and it's only with the benefit of godly hindsight that you realize how God has prepared you for what you're doing now, both through the good things and the bad things that happen in life. Anyway, that's enough about me and about the Center for Enterprise Markets and Ethics. I've set out on the next slide what we're going to cover over the next few sessions. You probably are aware of this from the advertising, but let me just bring it up. So tonight we're going to look at a biblical theology of work. Then next month we're going to look at the divine imperative of wealth creation, talk about wealth and so on. Then on the 15th of March, call and vocation. The 19th of April, enterprise and entrepreneurship. These things aren't completely distinct. There's a little bit of crossover in all of these sessions, which we will pick up as we go. But those are going to be the emphases. And then the intention in May is to have a discussion evening together where, all being well, I will travel up to Ealing and we will be able to have an evening together. So tonight we're unpacking a biblical theology of work as part of the first step, if you like, the first brick, the first building block as to why business matters to God. And I begin with three brief illustrations. And the first of those dates back to around 2010. Somebody sat next to me in church, just the church that I was attending in Oxford. I didn't have any particular role in the church. And I didn't know this individual who sat next to me. The sermon was terrible. It was absolutely awful. Now, I sometimes can be known to be a little critical of sermons, and my wife has been known to have to stretch out her hand and hold my arm and say, you know, just keep calm, just keep calm. But this was an absolutely awful sermon, an attack on business, an attack on banking, an attack on the market economy, based on what can only be described as real ignorance. Anyway, at the end, I chatted to the individual who'd come in to sit next to me. And I remember his words well when I asked him what his work was. He simply replied, "I am hated, but I am hated most of all by the church. I am a banker." Second illustration is a lawyer friend of mine working for a major firm in the city. And he told me that he was viewed by his church leadership as a cash machine. A cash machine in order to employ more ministry assistants. Such a viewpoint is highly destructive of human purpose and human dignity. The third example is a lunch I had a few years ago with a city trader who attended a well-known church in London. And he told me quite openly how much he had appreciated the teaching he'd received in this church over the course of some 30 years, had no criticism of the teaching that he'd received. And then he paused and said, but nothing, literally nothing, had ever helped him understand his place and role in the economy and in society. Those illustrations demonstrate to us the challenge that we face. Do we have the theological and biblical resources to equip us to do the following things? And I suppose, in essence, this is the aims and objectives of the course overall. Do we have the biblical resources and the theological resources to understand the role of business and the economy in God's world? And secondly, to appreciate the theology and biblical teaching around work, business, and the economy. And thirdly, to recognize the distinctive contribution that a Christian can bring, to bear to questions of calling, ethics, and values. In essence, those are the things we're going to be engaging with over the course of the next 3 weeks: understanding the role of business and the economy in God's world, appreciating the theological and biblical teaching around work, business, and the economy, and recognizing the distinctive contribution that a Christian can bring to bear on those questions. So we begin this evening then with a biblical theology of work. And this is what we're going to cover: and the significance and importance of work, theological approaches and principles to work, and what the Bible actually teaches about work. So I hope you can see the sort of direction we're going to be going. We're going to say something about the overall importance, something about how you might go about it theologically, what are the key principles, and then saying, well, what does the Bible actually say? What do we learn from the scriptures about work? That's roughly the direction of travel for this evening. So let's start with the significance and importance of work. Now, in 1942, Dorothy Sayers — some of you will know of Dorothy Sayers, others of you may not, I think it might be a generational thing — but in 1942, Dorothy Sayers gave an address on the subject, Why Work? And in that address, she stated that in respect of an intelligent carpenter — let me get my slide up here — the very first demand that his religion makes upon him is to make good tables. The very first demand that his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables. It's very important to know what she didn't say. She didn't say that the role is to convert the workforce or the customer. The first demand that his religion of an intelligent carpenter makes upon him is that he should make good tables. Now, she goes on to add that the very worst religious films that she had ever seen were those in which the actors were chosen exclusively for their piety. So this all raises for us two questions. And the first of those is, what is the purpose and the value of human work? And the second is there a priority given to spiritual work? We've almost got to set the groundwork by clarifying those questions. Why work at all? Addressing the first of those questions, the purpose and the value of human work. Why work at all? Why is it important? Now, of course, one approach is to argue that the reason we work is we have to eat. The reason we work is we've got to earn some money to pay the rent. We've got to earn some money to pay the mortgage. We've got to earn some money to put food on the table, to buy clothes, to provide for wants and needs. And this is known as the instrumental view of work. Work has no other purpose other than to provide. Just pause a moment and think about that. Roughly 50% of our waking hours are spent working for most of us. And are we really saying that work, in the eyes of God, has no purpose other than just to put some food on the table or to put a roof over our heads? And you can see how that instrumental view ties in with the idea that work is drudgery or even cursed. We'll come back to curse and the fall later. But that work is essentially a distraction from the truly spiritual parts of life. And that leads on to that second question. Is there a priority given to spiritual work? This suggestion that there is some intrinsic value under God in human work seems to have been replaced in much contemporary evangelical thinking by a pietism that emphasizes separation from the world and views evangelism as the only reason to be on the earth. Human work is essentially, in this view, only important if it enables spiritual work. Go back to my lawyer friend, high-earning lawyer, a very senior partner in one of the biggest law firms in the world, and his view of how his church leadership looked at him, a cash cow, someone to produce the money to pay for more ministers in the church. Such an approach is flawed. The role of the Christian in business in this model is to convert the person at the next desk, the customer or the client, the supplier, or to provide the money to pay for more evangelists. This approach is flawed. It destroys purpose and dignity in the part of our lives that occupies at least 50% of our waking hours. And it destroys ethics. You see, if your only job is to produce the money to pay for something else, and your work has no value in God's eyes other than that, then you will cut corners very quickly and without second thought. And the problem of this idea, of this approach, is it reduces most of our life to only secondary value in God's eyes. Slightly bizarrely, this outlook completely turns on its head the reformers' critique of the priority of spiritual work in medieval Catholicism and the reformed affirmation of the intrinsic value of all human work. One of the criticisms of medieval Catholicism is that they elevated the role of the monk. They elevated the role of the religious life, and that was seen as more important than ploughing the field. It's rather ironic that some parts of our reformed and evangelical constituencies seem to have gone back to that view in Protestant terms. But my contention is that business is much, much, much more important to God. Now, in essence, what Dorothy Sayers was doing in her address and what she was doing in that quote about the intelligent carpenter was establishing the principle of common grace and the idea of creation principles, two key theological principles we'll come to in a bit more detail shortly. And what these principles do is suggest that there is something of intrinsic, divine intrinsic value in work. So Darrell Cosden, who wrote a book called The Heavenly Good of Earthly Work, says, from a Christian point of view, all human work, and not just religious work, has eternal meaning and value. And again, to return to Dorothy Sayers, in the same address, Why Work? Work should be looked upon not as a necessary drudgery to be undergone for the purpose of making money, but as a way of life in which the nature of man should find its proper exercise and delight, and so fulfill itself to the glory of God. So there's something in work about it reflecting the purposes of God. There's something in work about our work reflecting God's glory. That's what we are going to explore. But it means, in a biblical theology of work, due to the nature and the goodness of God, work cannot be merely instrumental. There has to be something more than simply the drudgery involved of putting food on the table. Of course, work is necessary for reward and provision, but it is my contention, at least this evening, that from a biblical perspective, it is an expression also of human being and purpose. And consequently, we will see, as we turn to the theological principles of the biblical narrative, enterprise, entrepreneurship, beauty, and goodness are all elements of the divine that we find in human work. So let me turn, without further ado, to the second of the aspects that we're going to cover. The first was the significance and importance of work. I've sort of set the scene with that. The second, theological approaches and principles to work. Now, the idea of creation mandates is central to a biblical theology of work. And creation mandates establish a number of basic principles around human purpose, creativity, liberty, and dignity. They represent inalienable aspects of God's creation, reflection of what is known as common grace, God's divine action in the world he created for all people and by all people, redeemed or otherwise. So a creation principle is a principle set down in the origins of God's actions and purposes in creation prior to the fall, which conveys the intentions, demands, and ultimate ends of God for humanity for all time. I'll repeat that. A creation mandate is a principle set down in the origins of God's actions and purposes in creation, hence why they're called creation mandates, prior to the fall, but which conveys something of the purpose, the intention, the demands, the expectations, the ultimate ends of God for all of humanity for all of time. And there are three central aspects of how creation mandates and creation principles apply to work and enterprise. And the first of those is that God himself is presented as a worker in creation. God was truly the first worker. God was truly the first person to work, and the work that God did was the work of creation. And we see this in the creation narratives. You'll be familiar, I'm sure, with the ideas. So in Genesis 1:1, we read, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In Genesis 2:2-3, on the seventh day, God finished the work he had done. So right back in those first two chapters of Genesis, we see God's work in creation being described as work and being affirmed as the work, indeed the work of God. We're also told in Genesis 1:27, of course, that God created human beings in his own image. So the God in whose image was created, the God in whose image humanity was created, was also a worker, the first worker. And so consequently, men and women then were made in part to work, and by doing so, reflect this aspect of God's glory. It's a kind of a principle from derivation, really. God was the first worker. God created humanity in his image. Therefore, work must be part of that image of God created in the human person. So that was the first creation mandate, God as a worker in creation with humanity in his image. Second, the idea that since creation is good, so work as a participation in creation must also be intrinsically good. Now, we can get on and debate in the questions whether there are any limits to that, but at this point, I'm simply talking about the principle. Work glorifies God. The beauty of work is a reflection of the beauty and bountiful goodness of God. And further consequences derive from this principle. Work is good because the creation is good, Genesis 1:31. Work is creative because God creates, Genesis 1:1. And although we're going to look in more detail at entrepreneurship in a later week, you can even at this point begin to see where some of those principles are going to come from. If God is creative because he is the creator, then one would expect to see something of that creativity reflected in the image of God planted in humanity. Now, in addition to that, there is also another creation mandate which derives from this principle, that of human dignity. Since, as we have seen, humanity is created in the image of God, that dignity does not derive from the work itself. So our dignity under God doesn't come from the fact we do a certain type of work and not another type of work. It comes from the fact that God's image is in the worker. And that is why Calvin wrote as follows. No work will be so mean and sordid as not to have splendor and value in the eyes of God. It's a very, very important point. There isn't a hierarchy of work. So when the man who sat next to me in the church told me that he was hated because he was a banker, not so. No more and no less a reflection of the glory of God as a manual worker, somebody working in the fields, or somebody working elsewhere in financial services, service industries, and so on. There isn't a hierarchy of work when it comes to reflecting the glory of God. Now, as we will discuss in later weeks and later on this evening, perhaps even, obviously, questions are raised of ethics in the conduct of work, but questions of ethics are raised in the conduct of any work. The point is that the glorification of God comes from the fact that the image of God is reflected in the worker, so that therefore, as Calvin says, no work will be so mean and sordid as not to have splendor and value in the eyes of God. So, just going back to creation mandates, the first one was God as a worker in creation, creating humanity in his image. The second one, creation is good. We're told Genesis 1:31 that creation is good. The Lord looked and saw that it was good. Therefore, work is good. And the third is that humanity is mandated to work as part of God's purpose in creation. This creation mandate is the command to work itself. It goes back to the picture I had on the first slide. I was looking for P pictures of the Garden of Eden. Now, you know, I know, I absolutely get we don't have pictures of the Garden of Eden. You know, I was looking for a picture of the Garden of Eden to put up on the introductory slide. They're just all so awful. There was just, you know, it's Adam and Eve holding hands and walking through the garden and all this sort of stuff. So I just put a picture of somebody working the ground with Genesis 2:15 next to it. Genesis 2:15, a central verse for establishing these principles of creation. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. Working the garden was part of the very purpose of God for humanity from the beginning. And so work transforms nature and provides human fulfillment. Next week, when we look at the issue of wealth creation, we will go back to this verse, Genesis 2:15, and look at some of the surrounding material to demonstrate the divine imperative of wealth creation. But for now, it's just that verse. The Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to work it and keep it. Consequently, industriousness is a virtue and a moral habit. And God's creation represents part of the givenness of the moral order. There is, therefore, an obligation to work. Again, and we can explore this in questions. That raises a number of questions for us in a fallen world. And I'll come a little bit later to the consequences of the fall. But it implies the central importance of having work, because work reflects the image of God. So there are issues about unemployment, if for any reason people can't work, and there's issues about moral purpose, character, laziness, desire, wish, intention to work. And we'll come to some of those things a little bit later. So work, we've established, has value in its own right and cannot be reduced to simply instrumental purposes. Now, this creation mandate also means that the creation of goods and services of value and of wealth reflects God's very nature. That's what we'll come back to. Economic growth comes from humanity's application in the production process of the riches and richness of God's creation. But more of that next week and subsequently. Now, we see all of this, all of these ideas behind the creation mandates, we see reflected in the teaching of the Reformers, and interestingly, also in modern Roman Catholic teaching. I have a quote that I often use in talks that I will put up in a couple of weeks' time, and I won't disclose the source. And it's a reminder to us of how things have changed. Anyway, let's just go back to the Reformers briefly. So Calvin conveyed this essential dignity of work. Here's Calvin again. Even the artisan with the humblest trade is good at it only because the Spirit of God works in him. For though these gifts are diverse, they all come from the one Spirit. It pleased God to distribute them to each one, 1 Corinthians 12:4. This does not refer only to spiritual gifts which follow regeneration, but to all the sciences which concern our use of the common life. Calvin, brilliantly there, setting up that relationship between spiritual gifts that might come after regeneration with the general endowment of gifts on humanity by God for all people, for all time, for the conduct of our common life. And Calvin goes on, and I've got a few quotes I'm going to go through here for the next few minutes. In his commentary on Genesis, indeed commenting on Genesis 2:15, Calvin comments, here Moses adds that the earth was leased to man on this condition, that he busies himself cultivating it. It follows from this that men were made to employ themselves doing something and not to be lazy and idle. So again, you see something there of the intrinsic purpose in work, and also some warnings about how we should not react to the requirement to work. We'll come to those a bit later on. He added, Calvin added in his commentary on the harmony of the evangelists, that we know that men were created for the express purpose of being employed in labour of various kinds. In his own commentary on Genesis 2:15, Luther said this: man was created not for leisure, but for work, even in the state of innocence. Modern Roman Catholic teaching. Pope John Paul II, in his encyclical Laborum Exercens, which was published in 1981, which means through work, I've just been commissioned to write a book chapter on a Protestant view of Laborum Exercens, the Pope's encyclical. But this is what the Pope says. And in fact, if I hadn't told you that this was the Pope, you would have thought it was Calvin. The Church finds in the very first pages of the book of Genesis the source of her conviction that work is a fundamental dimension of human existence on earth. And the emphasis there isn't mine, it's the Pope's in the original. And Pope John Paul II goes on to add, these truths are decisive for man from the very beginning. So what we've got actually is a united common Christian tradition affirming the centrality, nature, and purpose of work as a creation mandate, a creation principle derived from God's action in creation. Therefore, it has significance, it has purpose, it reflects the glory, the beauty of God himself. And it is for all people, for all time. Well, we've done two-thirds of the material, the significance and importance of work, theological approaches and principles to work. And for the last part of this, I'm going to turn then to the question of what the Bible actually teaches about work. I suppose what I mean here is other than in the creation narratives. I'm going to move on from the creation narratives and ask about what the Bible tells us and teaches us about work in the rest of the material. Now, clearly, I'm only going to be able to do this in relatively brief terms, but we might summarize the biblical teaching in a number of ways. First, in the development of enterprise and entrepreneurship. Familiar, aren't we, with Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and then the fall in Genesis 3? And everybody knows the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis 4. But actually, it is in Genesis 4 that we begin to see, right from those earliest of days, the development of commerce, enterprise, and business. Cain and Abel are examples of the early examples, of course, of the principle of specialization, one concentrating on livestock, the other on arable. Let me just turn to those verses. So Genesis 4, verse 2. Abel was a keeper of sheep and Cain a worker of the ground. So immediately, right back in the beginnings, we see that principle of specialization. Both are at work and both are in business. Later on in that chapter, Genesis 4, 20 to 22, we see the family tree of Lamech illustrated by reference to those who raised livestock, played stringed instruments, and forged iron and bronze tools. I should have kept my Bible open because it's an aspect that's often just glossed over. So Genesis 4, 20 to 22, Adar bore Jabel. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. Do you see, in Genesis 4, the future branches of humanity are being described in relation to their work, their business, and their enterprise. And the basic point and the reason for giving some weight to those verses is simply to illustrate that this is a normal part of the biblical narrative. Work is there in creation, and we see it develop in the period after the fall. So, second principle, if you like, about what the Bible teaches about work is it's the Lord who endows with skill. I'm going to put some verses up in a moment. We will come back to in slightly fuller fashion next month, next time that we meet, because it has a lot of implications for the principle of entrepreneurship. But for this evening, I just wanted to put these verses up in order to illustrate the principle that God endows our gifts and skills. So this is Exodus 35, 30 to 33. You're in the midst of all of those instructions for the construction of the tabernacle, all of those details that are in those chapters in Genesis. And then we get in verses 30 to 33. Then Moses said to the Israelites, "See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel. He has filled him with divine spirit, with skill, intelligence, and knowledge in every kind of craft, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, and in carving wood, in every kind of craft, in every skilled craft." You've got there the basic principle that Calvin was talking about. The Lord endows people with gifts and skills for the conduct of work. So let me just move on a little bit. So the development of enterprise and entrepreneurship, the Lord endows with skill. That was just the simple point I was seeking to make from that quote. And now let's just have a look briefly at work in the New Testament. Again, there's a lot more that could be said, but just to give a flavor, an overview, we have many examples of people involved in business and work in business in the New Testament, including Lydia, a dealer in purple cloth, Acts 16, 14. Paul, of course, the tent maker, Acts 18, 3. And of course, the example of Jesus himself. Jesus worked as a carpenter. We know that from Mark 6, 3, in his earthly father's family business. And there can be no doubt at all that Jesus will have experienced the stresses, strains, and joys of business life and entrepreneurial life. As an aside, it is inconceivable that Joseph's business enterprise was anything other than profitable in order to have been sustainable over some 30 years. We will come next month, I nearly said next week, next month, to look at the morality of profit. But just as a hint, I will be arguing that profit is a deeply moral concept. Doesn't mean all profits are made in a way they should be. It doesn't mean there are no questions to discuss. I'm getting ahead of myself. Think also of the fishermen apostles. They also clearly included some people of wealth and means. We know from Mark 1:20 that some of them were business partners and employed others. So you see all of these examples and hints coming from various aspects of business in the New Testament. The early apostles, independent business people in a thriving fishing industry. I mean, I'm clear a lot more could be said about work in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. I've only tried just to give a little bit of an overview. And there's one more thing to cover before we stop. And that is to think about some of the warnings in Scripture. This really comes about because although we've not really considered in detail the impact of the fall on work. Now, clearly, the fall means that work is not perfect or entirely as the Lord intended because of our fallen world. And that is why the Scripture contains warnings about work and its conduct. The principle of work is clearly established in the creation narratives, but as a consequence of the fall, there are warnings about how we behave and how we conduct our work. And Colossians 3:23 reminds us that in Christian discipleship, whatever your task, put yourselves into it as done for the Lord. And the scriptural warnings which we're going to look at are of two types. Firstly, warnings against laziness. The Bible is strongly opposed to laziness. Hard work is held in respect. And indeed, again, as we'll see next month, hard work is indeed linked to the acquisition of wealth and well-being. Laziness is chided. Proverbs 10:4-5. I haven't put this on a slide. I'll just read it out. A slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. A child who gathers in summer is prudent, but a child who sleeps in harvest brings shame. There are further warnings against laziness in Proverbs 6:6. Go to the ant, you lazy bones. Consider its ways and be wise. And in the New Testament, in 2 Thessalonians 3:10, anyone unwilling to work should not eat. Well, we could probably generate a whole evening of discussion just around those verses. But these are moral warnings which give weight to personal responsibility under God to work. And work is always the best way out of poverty. I'm not an advocate of prosperity gospel. I mean, some of you might be, I don't know. I'm not an advocate of the prosperity gospel. I'm an advocate of understanding the way in which work and wealth and enterprise and entrepreneurship operate in the scriptures. Affirmed by God, part of God's purpose, but carrying warnings and challenges because of the fall. But it is a warning that we should always be somewhat wary of excess dependence on government bailouts, government welfare programs. Paul Levy said to me, I was allowed to be really controversial. So just in case people have fallen asleep, I'm going to kick in a really controversial thing. I think I'm the only person in the land with reservations about Marcus Rashford's campaign for extending free school meals across the entire year, even when people aren't in school, when it seems to me the principal responsibility lies with the parent. Now, you can take me apart on that in question time. You can tell me I'm wrong. That's all fine. I'm simply trying to stir things up a little bit just in that respect. But what I'm actually trying to do is just give some illustrations of the biblical injunctions against laziness. How those apply obviously becomes a matter of debate. But the second group of warnings in Scripture are warnings against exploitation. Both the Mosaic law and the teaching of the New Testament offered protections to workers and limits to work to provide the moral basis, if you like, for work ethics. So again, not going through all of those, but Leviticus 19:13, injunction against holding back wages, Jeremiah 22:13, warning about growing wealthy at the expense of the honest laborer. You'll be familiar with the injunctions of Amos against dishonest business practices and so on. And then in the New Testament, there is both the affirmation of property rights, incentivization, and the ownership of capital, which we'll come to in February, but alongside that, warnings about wealth and pride and acquisition and so on and so forth. So the Bible affirms business, work and wealth, but also warns against exploitative practices and ungodly behaviors. So let me leave you with some simple conclusions as we begin our quest. Why does business matter to God? Partly because of our biblical theology of work. And just running through these, work has intrinsic value and reflects God's glory. Secondly, the creation mandates demonstrate the importance and significance of work. Thirdly, all human work reflects God's character, not just spiritual. Fourthly, the Bible shows the central place of work, business, and entrepreneurship. And fifth, finally, the Bible warns against both laziness and oppression or exploitation. Why does business matter to God? Well, the central significance of work is the first reason. Well, thank you for listening.